Taking the ride on the Freedom Train podcast series. I'm your host, Joseph Ward, and as always, ride with me is my good homie, Mr. Patrick Irvin. Remember, the Freedom Train is brought to you by PAX Inc. That's PACTSINC. And PAX Inc. is a black development organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with a trace of hard work, honesty, and integrity. For more information, make sure you go on and visit www.pactsinc.org to learn more about the organization, the codes of conduct, what they offer, how to get involved with the organization, as well as the Learning Center where you can learn much about black history and the culture and the politics and all that thing that got to do with black liberation. So once again, that's www.pactsinc.org. While you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.org. .com, packed and suited it up. It's all pretty and stuff. Got our mental health awareness section going on and everything about our shows, our weekly lineup of shows. Go ahead and go to the website, www.freedomtrainradio.com, right here on the Freedom Train Network where we get it in and we do our thing. Pat.
Yeah.
Tell them about the app.
Man, so we got the app, right? No, I'm talking about
right,
I did
right.
So right. You go and you get the app. And you download the app on your phone, but only if you got an Android. If you got an iPhone, then fuck you. Sorry, just playing. But if you got an Android, you go get the app from the Google Play Store. It's a real small app, and you get the app, and then you get notifications whenever any other shows come out or released or anything else. Or maybe we just want to see you a vote to say, hey, how you doing? So you get a notification anytime anything come out, and you get it right on your phone. It's a small app, so you know that's how you follow us. You stay in touch. You keep doing what it do, moving how it moves. You ain't got to worry about going to the website, checking stuff out. You ain't got to worry about going to your favorite show, typing in the Freedom Train Presents, trying to find all that other stuff. No, it's all right there on your phone, right in the app. So get the app, because the app is what the app is, and it do what it do, and that's what you need it to do.
There it is. That's the audition for them ghetto commercials. There it is. And remember, you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Radio Republica, Freedom Train Network. We on Facebook, Freedom Train Network, YouTube, Freedom Train Network, Instagram, Freedom Train Network, Twitter. We're at Freedom Train Net. But we actually just type in Freedom Train Network. We actually, you're going to find us. And we get it in.
You know,
so
what's crazy?
What?
And this is how you know we black folk.
What?
The Radio Republic thing is called Radio Republic. And every week for like the past 4 or 5 weeks, we've been calling it Radio Republica.
Yeah. They know what we mean. We black, I guess. Do they? I don't know. But Radio Republic, then. There it is.
I'm going to still be saying Radio Republic because that's how the fuck I say it.
Me too.
You feel
me? You know what I'm talking about. So, man, today, right, we got our good homie family on the Freedom Train Network. We got Professor Carl Tone Jones on the show today. And, you know, this is us continuing our Mental Health Awareness Month. So we had to bring the good brother back. You know, we had him on last year to talk about mental health awareness. So we had to bring him back again this year because, you know, we had a great discussion. He dropped some jewels last year. So we want to make sure that we refresh our memories and drop some more jewels on us. But before we get deep into the interview, you know, because I'm sure y'all already know about the professor and all those things there, but just to give y'all a look, man, a little refresher real quick. You know, he created the What About Us organization and the whataboutus.com. He created that. He is the director, the producer, the man, the creator of the Independence Day Project documentary, which was a revolutionary documentary talking about practical things that the black community can do to actually liberate ourselves from the throes of white supremacy. He has the Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones, the podcast that's right here on the Freedom Train Network. He works within the mental health field. He's an educator. He's in the streets of Philadelphia on a regular basis, working with the kids, making sure that he's inspiring them to read more, to learn more, to think outside the box. When we're talking about in the streets, he's part of the Block by Block campaign with the brothers in Philadelphia, where they actually are in the streets, walking the streets, helping the community, helping to build the community up, making sure things are safe, policing the community. And that's just a little short list of the things that he do within the community. And, you know, he's a great brother. So we want everybody to get up on your feet, put your hands together. I want my homeboy in a little shirt to go ahead and raise his sign up high. Put your hands together. Press hard, come on. What's going on, Professor?
Hell, what's going on? Peace and Black Power, brothers. Cool suit.
Yes, sir. Cool suit.
Yes, sir. For those who don't know what that is, that's an acronym that we like to use in terms of endearment in regards to our late great ancestor Malcolm X. And it was something that he would say in his lectures and teachings toward the end of his life, and it would basically mean wake up, clean up, stand up. So, you know, we're pushing now to get the community to wake up, clean itself, you know, from all the filth of white supremacy, all the bad habits we've learned, and to then stand up so that we can stand up and be accounted for and then take care of the things we need to go about empowering ourselves, you know, Black First Nation, you know, and then proving our conditions once and for all.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So real quick, I want you, could you tell the people a bit about your podcast? Because we're always shouting you out. We're always talking about your podcast, but can you tell the people a little bit about your podcast?
Wait. Because the podcast just went on hiatus. The show he just did was the last one.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. So Office Hours was originally designed to speak on relative and current issues as it pertained to the community that weren't being addressed by either mainstream media or even so-called Black conscious media, you know, and giving it from, you know, breaking things down into layman's terms where regular people can understand, so you didn't have to deal with a whole bunch of hyperbole, articulation, and, an explicit use of words where you would have to research or get an encyclopedia or to figure out what people were talking about. You know, Office Hours was the people's voice. It was the voice for the Black community. And we have recently wrapped up our last episode. We've gone strong for, you know, over a year now. Actually, maybe even a couple of years, but we're going strong. But there comes a time when you have to address certain things and deal with certain things. So Office Hours will return. But it will return under a different format where we start to interview key figures in the community, up and coming, you know, people of influence. And we'll still break from time to time. We'll still be providing some, you know, feedback in regards to, you know, issues and concerns regarding the news that's popping off in our community. But so right now, you know, we have to take a little hiatus. And so we're taking our break. We'll be back, though, but we're taking our break right now.
It is. See, Pat?
I did it.
All right, man. Man, let's go ahead and jump into this interview so we can talk a little bit about mental health and they can learn a little more. So, Pat, you know how we do. You got the first question. Let's do this thing.
The first question is a softball. And I don't, your PC, we don't need to be giving PC no softballs. You know? We don't need to be throwing him no alley hoops and all that. You know what? Our fan base is rabid. And they want blood in the water. In the water.
All right.
You feel me?
That's happening.
So I'm going to start out like this. Now I'm supposed to ask, right? Can you give us some brief background information? You know, and Joe already did that. Tell us what you've been up to lately. Look, We already know because they already listen to your podcast. They listen to Office Hours. They already know what you've been up to. And if they don't know, then they some sucker ass fish motherfuckers. You feel me?
Yeah. Get them.
So what I want to know is
what it is.
In your last podcast, right?
Right.
You talked a lot about black folk that ain't gonna make it. You know, people that needed to be cut off from the community. You know, people that you used the analogy of the 300 and the babies being thrown off the mountain for being invalid.
Mm-hmm.
We talking about mental health. So can you expound on that a little bit in terms of what exactly from a mentality standpoint, what exactly do we need from people and what exactly does that mean? What exactly are we looking at when we're saying these people need to be cut off?
Well, one of the things you got to look at is if can somebody be rehabilitated to be productive in your community? And if the answer to that question is no, then we have to start looking at alternatives. Now, as African-centered people, you know, there was no such things as prisons. You have no recollection of jails, dungeons, or any of those things in Africa. What you did have, however, is community exile, where people would be exiled from the village. They'd be exiled from the chiefdom. And so we need to start exiling cats, people that are not willing to conform to the best standards for our community. What does that mean? If you're more likely to kill brothers and sisters than you are to heal brothers and sisters, then we need you out of here. You know, I understand some people are suffering mental health issues and debilitated situations and whatnot, but there's also a case where, you know, people are beyond repair, beyond reproach. And beyond, you know, saving. So when you have individuals who you cannot save, you cannot reach to, that they've already developed a black heart, if you will, then those people, no matter what you do, are already enemies to the community. No matter how you try to save them, and you'll lose a lot of good people trying to save those dark hearts, those black hearts that don't want anything to do with building. They have taken on the mindset of your colonizer. They see you the same way your colonizer sees you. And they see themselves in a similar predatorial stance to your community as your colonizer sees you. So, therefore, you have to address them the same way you address a colonizer. And sometimes with more force because you want to discourage that behavior from anybody that may be watching. You know, specifically young people that may be watching the situation unfold. You want to make sure that you provide a good example of what it means and what we should do to people who have declared themselves enemies to whatever nation we're trying to build. So, but there are a lot of young brothers and sisters who are confused. And once you, you know, start building that seed, start planting that seed of nationhood in them, you know, to be black first, to be African-centered, and to understand their importance to the village, there are some young brothers and sisters who will come around and become a necessity, you know, in terms of what we need in that village. They'll provide themselves as a resource. They'll provide themselves as teachers. They'll provide themselves as laborers. They'll provide themselves, you know, some of these young brothers and sisters are genius, so they'll apply that to what we need. But the bottom line is, you know, if we can't reach them, and that's not just the youth, that's all the board, because we have some olders, not elders, some olders that need to be walked to the ledge and pushed off the plank. You know what I'm saying? So then that's what must be done. But, you know, we're in a place right now where we're in probably the most severe crisis for black people that the history of the world has ever seen. And a lot of us, you know, are not necessarily given the proper respect to our current situation that we're in. So there's a lot of people who don't understand this. And so they're not seeing the writing on the wall. The black community is under siege to a point where we can possibly be facing an LA event, an extinction level event, in regards to how our community is set up and how our communities run. And so because we're dealing with such dire times, we have to take extreme measures to protect ourselves against our real enemies, and those are the purveyors and the creators and the movers and shakers of white supremacy.
Now, what would you say to those people that would say, well, who are you to judge? Who are you to determine who get kicked in, who get kicked out? Maybe you need to be kicked out because maybe you got, maybe your mentality is damaging to the community.
Well, I mean, they may be right in respect of in perspective of what they consider to be the community. We have a lot of black people who don't see the creation of an African nation within a nation, or black nationalist nation within a nation, as their particular goal. We have a lot of people who I would classify as reformists, who will want to reform the current conditions of this government, of this system, so that it treats black people with a little kinder glove, you know, a little kinder than it has in the past. They still see themselves fitting into the system. So for them, they would want to kick me out, and I would want to be out of their grasp. You know, typically speaking, it's not the people within, I mean, on the outside that I'm concerned with. It's the people who have the same ideals and the same concerns and the same visions that we nationalists have in regard to building a safer place for black people, a place where we can insulate black people and we can build futures for black children and protect them. You know, there's a certain place that we reside, spiritually, mentally, intellectually, and soon physically, hopefully, that we don't want those interlopers to come to. We don't want them to be a part of what we're trying to build. So, you know, we're not from this whole mindset that, you know, we're looking for a utopia for black people. You have to have a certain mindset, because these brothers and sisters, or these black people that still believe in the integrationist mindset, they're quite dangerous to what we're trying to build. We've never seen the colonizers anything more than the colonizer. We haven't seen them as friends. We haven't seen them as equals. We haven't seen them as allies. And so, you know, when we have a people that want to include and have white inclusions and consider them to be comrades, things that and the other, well, now you're jeopardizing what we're trying to build over here. Show me a time the white man has ever joined a cause for black people and not interfered to mitigate the gains of black people. You know, and that'll be the first time in history you've ever seen that, never shown it. I mean, with all due respect to even John Brown, you know, we have not seen that type of coalition that looks to empower black people. So,
all right. Well, I just wanted to ask. I heard the last show. like I said, it was a bang to go out on. You definitely offered a lot, and you stirred the pot a lot. And I could hear, you know, people listening to that and having those questions. So I did want to go ahead while we had you to try to ask those questions, give you a chance to expound on what you were saying a little bit, so that those people that did hear the show and are feeling some type of way or whatever the case might be, you know, you got extra content now.
Yes, they do.
Yes, sir. So let me ask this. From your perspective, from your experience and your knowledge or your studies, how does white supremacy have a negative effect on the black health? How does white supremacy have a negative effect on the mental health of black Americans?
Because it's oppressive in every way. When you oppress a people, when you oppress a person, you take them out of their natural state of being, their natural state of functioning. And white supremacy has taken black people out of our natural state of just living. We live in a dysfunctional society that criminalizes everything we do. it penalizes us just for being black, and it punishes us for trying to exceed, even within their standards, the low expectations for black people. So at every gate, every possible door, there's a gate put up that lets black people see what they could have, but the gate impedes them from what they can actually access. That's white supremacy. The systems that are put in place purposefully to demonize being black, to demonize, I mean, you have black children who, before they're the age of 4 or 5, they already hate being in their own black skin, because their white supremacy has shown them that through their lens, that black is not beautiful, that black is trouble, that black is dangerous. So black children will choose not to associate themselves with black baby dolls. You know, you have that from the onset. Then you have it reinforced in school, where the school districts are predominantly white women. 90% of all teachers in public schools are white women. And you have black children who go into these institutions who legally become the parents of these children once they enter the doors. They legally become the parents. And once they're inside the school door, you know, the doors of the school, now they have to appease this white woman with their schoolwork. They have to do things to get happy faces on their plate, on their notebooks for writing neatly. They have to appease her behavior-wise to get a star on their forehead. You know, so it basically replaces the authority figure. No longer are black parents seen as the authority figures, because the children spend more time actively in the day with these teachers, with the faculty. They spend more time under the authority. So when these children leave school, we're shown that black school-age black children are treated like adults by police, adults who've committed crimes. So when I would do lectures in high schools, I would, you know, bring up the instance where the children would be accosted by police and they hadn't done anything. And the children would say, yo, how did you know that? Because that's post-traumatic, you know, that's post-traumatic response to something we've already been conditioned to. So white supremacy does all those things before that child is even old enough to see the world, to see the outside, you know, to see outside of this prison. So the children, you know, so we become dysfunctional, but we've normalized the dysfunction. And that's all a symptom of white supremacy. We've normalized with so-called ghetto behavior. We've normalized keeping our communities dirty and trashy. We've normalized criminal behavior toward one another. We've normalized thinking that poverty is the way we should all be living. We've normalized disrespect. You know, we've normalized all these different things. We've normalized, biggest of all, self-hatred. We've normalized hating who we are and who we look like. We've normalized those things. So, you know, we have to come to grips with all the damage that is in place, not just what the child is born into, because I hadn't even gotten to crack cocaine and what that has done to the previous three generations. But, you know, we've normalized all the dysfunction and accepted it as this is the black American experience. And then we think it's just unique to us until we see global white supremacy. And then we understand that this is it's a global phenomenon that affects all black people, non-black people, but mostly black people. I mean, non-white people, excuse me.
Okay, so you are the fourth person this month who we've interviewed during our Mental Health Awareness Month who talked about post-traumatic stress that black people suffer from the hands of white supremacists. And we've had discussions about the effects of white supremacy on our mental health, just like you just answered. So can you help us understand, and my bad, Pat, I know I'm jumping, but can you help us understand what white supremacy is and how it really breaks us down and how it really goes around and kind of puts us in this place of suppression?
Okay. Yeah, sure. and the onset of white supremacy. All right, let's remember that white supremacy started off as a way for Europeans to create the economic necessary for them to build an empire that we know as America. Okay, America itself is the bastion of white supremacy, not Europe, America. Because the creation of America was done with the free labor of African slaves. Now, we can argue about whether or not it was African or Native American. Regardless, they were black. And the system was put in place that the system was put in place to make sure that this particular edition of slavery was race-based. And through that, you had to break the spirit because for some strange reason, it goes without saying. People assume that our ancestors, first of all, sold us into slavery. That wasn't true. A lot of them their hands were forced, unfortunately. But second of all, that many of our ancestors came here willingly. They accepted bondage without putting up a fight. No, there were plenty of slave rebellions. There were plenty of rebellions. There were ship rebellions. Rebellions on those ships. There were rebellions, in Africa. There were rebellions here in America and throughout the diaspora. But so they had to create a system to break us. So they did things like buck breaking. They did things like torture. They did things that were so inhumane when they developed this system of chattel slavery, that they infused a certain type of mindset that made it where black people were, the fight was beaten out of us. And the system of slavery here was so savage that it's been passed down traditionally for generations. So you talk about how does white supremacy affect us and what it is. So the system of white supremacy is a power system. It's a system based in power and making sure that the power stays in the hands of white folk, and is protected through systems and systemically to make sure they never lose power to non-white folk, if we want to just say it in the simplest terms.
Mm-hmm.
They've created systems that are layered and protections to which if you're trying to navigate through this system, you will never have all of the rights, the privileges, the perks that come with being white. You can only assume some of them. But then again, the system has checks and balances, as these rich black millionaires and almost billionaires have been finding out, that the system has systems in place that will break you down. They have modules in place, codes of ethic, codes of conduct in place, to make sure that you will never achieve within their system a measurement of what people would call fairness. So because you have a system that's based in that, and a system that maintains the same ethics and the same etiquette as slavery, it's no wonder that it has a similar effect to black people as we saw on plantations. Every aspect of black people in society today, you saw prior to the end of slavery. When you start talking about some of the conditions of prison, all you have to do is look on plantations. They got the hole in prison. They got the hole. They had the hole on plantations. They got, isolation. They got the isolation here in society. You got, you had vagrant laws, and where if you were caught sleeping or napping somewhere, you were put in jail. Well, look what they do to black homeless people. Look what they do to black people who just end up in the wrong place. So they constantly remind black people that this is a prison state for black people. So the necessity to have our own community is simple. Black people aren't the only people that the system of white supremacy has tried to encourage on. They tried to encourage on other members of European descent before they allowed them membership into the club of white supremacy, because the concept of race is just that. It's a concept. It's not necessarily not necessarily based on your skin color. So there's some dark-skinned Italians and Frenchmen and Spanish men that would, make me blush, all right? But, there was a situation where, in the South, some Italians were lynched. But the state of the nation state of Italy forced America to apologize because they had a nation state. They said, we will take you to war for harming our citizens. Well, we don't have that. So we have to create that. We have to create a nation state within black people who happen to be here in America, but it has to be African-centered. It can't be centered on the same values as the things we like to relish in. We like to talk about Black Wall Street. We like to talk about Rosewood. We like to talk about Slocum. We like to talk about all those different places that had black power at one time but lost it. Well, a lot of those places tried to mimic and imitate the white communities that they just came from. And because they didn't have any ties to one another, they didn't see the need to reach out and join forces with other black and African settlements at that time. And then so, therefore, they were isolated. We need to have an insulated state where we have insulated protections financially, economically, culturally, and militarily, so that we can protect what we have and protect what we keep, so that we can hold other nations accountable for how they treat us. You wouldn't see black people getting gunned down in the streets if we had our own nation. You wouldn't see, you know, black women being beaten up in Korean nail salons if we had our own nation. You damn sure don't see the other half of that. You don't see black people going around beating up Asians. You don't see black people just gunning down white folk in the street. Definitely don't see, you've seen less than 5 cases of black cops shooting white boys. You know, so these are the things that we need, because we need those national, those protections that are given to a nation state.
Right.
I can go on, but, you know, I know we don't have a lot of time.
You know, we also wouldn't see black women getting beat up and choked out and strangled and all that other stuff in Asian stores if they would stop going. Oh,
yeah.
Did I not post say that too soon?
Right. But when you have an understanding of your culture and who you are, you wouldn't have a necessity to go to those stores, you know. Or, like we said earlier in the show, some people need to be put on a ship, and somebody need to kick that ship off the ledge and let that ship float. Well, how the Eskimos used to do, they would take their elders and put them on an iceberg. Well, you know, maybe we need to go shop around, see if we can find some icebergs.
Iceberg slim, my dear bear. So I'm actually glad that you answered the question, because I've been asking, and I was just that's a personal thing for me, because I have been real, and you guys have known me long enough, you know that I'm real big on definitions, and most of the misunderstandings we have in the world can be boiled down to somebody having a different definition or understanding of a word than the one that's presented. So when he asked you about white supremacy, that's one of those things for me that it's always interesting to hear how people define white supremacy, because I've yet to hear any two people define it in the exact same way. So, and that's even amongst friends and allies and people that I know fully understand the system, they still have their nuanced definitions of what white supremacy is. So that's always been an interesting thing for me. So I know that might just be me being a nerd, but it was interesting. It was, you know what? You guys can get off my back. Why does everybody pick on me all the time? It's so not cool. So not cool.
Hey man, this is a witch, this right month for you.
Arguing with my see Joe. Anyways, so we had a cognitive behavioral specialist on the show last week, our other resident expert, and you are a behavioral specialist consultant. Is there any difference between the two?
If I'll be perfectly honest, I'm not necessarily sure what a cognitive behavioral specialist is, other than if I were just to take the definition of, you know, what that would be, and I guess that would be controlling people's thought processes or whatever, but I'm not sure because I've never quite heard of that. It could just be that in different regions, the same position and title or the same position or the same job or, you know, they just have different names. Mm-hmm. So I could tell you what a behavioral specialist consultant is, because what we basically are prescribers of behavior. And our job is to go into a situation, assess a client's behavior, and to create a treatment plan with goals and objectives to get the client to exhibit more positive behaviors and decrease the negative behaviors. So the process is basically we establish a baseline of behavior where we are, and then we establish the behaviors that the client is currently doing, performing or exhibiting. And then amongst that, we, like I said, we develop a treatment plan of goals. Let's say if we have a client who, you know, is physically aggressive, you know, with their peers 100% of the time. Every time they it's playtime, the client is hitting somebody. You know, we'll say our goal is for the client to decrease the physical, you know, being physically aggressive and not hitting someone. You got to be specific, you know, 4 out of 5 times, or we'll say 3 out of 5 times. And then, you know, we'll implement objectives, and basically we'll depend on who's responsible, whether it's a mobile therapist, whether it's a therapeutic support staff member, whether it's either a parent or a teacher, will have different duties and roles that they are to correspond with to help minimize the negative behaviors and to help actualize or increase the positive behaviors through incentives most of the time. So, you know, in a nutshell, we write a prescription, a treatment to help present desirable behaviors in the client.
Okay. Now, you know, Pat, and knowing is half the battle. Yeah.
I don't believe that.
You don't believe what? Knowing is half the battle?
Yeah, I don't.
Okay. You got to set up with G.I. Joe.
I will, actually. I most definitely will, because I think he lied, because people know a lot of things, and that can't be half the battle. I give him maybe a third of the battle, 33%. I give him that. I can't give him half.
Right. That sounds fair.
So
why are we arguing G.I. Joe philosophies, Joe?
We?
Yeah, I'm just going to throw that back. All right, so anyways, what behavioral issues have you noticed? And I know you have clients that are all across the spectrum. But what have you noticed, if you've noticed anything, in some of the black clients that you serve? And how do you use your training to help clients modify their behaviors?
A lot of times in black clients, basically what I see is that all hope has been removed from them. They, you know, they suffer more so the effects of white supremacy than most people, because a lot of times they're misdiagnosed. They're just given a diagnosis because they're acting out. And so you'll have a client that's listed, you know, as having aggressive behaviors, or, you know, there's things like aggressive behavior disorder, you know, where, you know, the clients are allotted a large range of things that could be applied to just being aggressive. And most of the times the clients are misunderstood. The behaviors start from the fact that they might not be properly educated. And what I mean by that is, if you have a child who is a tactile learner, but you don't have a teacher that's efficient in teaching a tactile learner, then that child is going to struggle in that classroom. That teacher will then file, you know, place they'll place restraints or restrictions on those children, which will then cause more of a, you know, outlash or outburst. You know, we have a lot of children who have not been taught how to deal with their anguish. So they have outbursts. And a lot of times the places and environment exacerbate that. So one of the things I try to do is to instill some confidence in the children. Just focus on the things they're doing well. And also, I tell them the truth about white supremacy to help them understand why they're being picked on by their teachers. Why is it that in their own household, their parents don't understand, you know, the importance of them learning about self? You know, so we bring it home. You know, we get engaged. I'm unapologetic with my clients. If it's a little black boy, I'm saying you should not be out here chasing white girls. There's going to be a consequence for that. The society's going to find for you. And often, if they don't listen, they'll learn. They'll deal with that consequence themselves, usually in front of a judge. So, you know, I'm very upfront with my clients, my black clients, about the world that they live in and how they need to walk and how, what they need to be aware of. And I'm also real clear with their parents about the things that they've allowed to go on and permit persist for so long. So when we talk about dealing with our clients, the first thing I identify with them is the system of white supremacy, because it brings clarity to their situation and struggles.
It is.
In your face.
Boom.
How does that work out, being unapologetic with your clients? Don't, like, what? I'm sure there are clients that take issue with that.
They can if they want to. They then can request a therapist. I'm not going to put that child in a place where that child is not going to be able to succeed, and I'm not going to lie to that child about the world they live in. One of the biggest issues we have is we lie to the children, because this dysfunction, we try to normalize. And then when they see through it, we try to make them seem dysfunctional for seeing the truth of the matter, truth of the matter of the world they live in. So, you know, and I explain to the parents, listen, this is the world we live in. And often the parents are relieved because I'm saying things they're afraid to say. So, you know, when we have the treatment plans and evaluations, things of that nature, I'm upfront with this. I'm telling black children, listen, they're trying to kill you and lock you up. And all you're doing is you're giving them the gun, you're giving them the ammunition, you're giving them the bullets by doing these things. So let's take the guns and the bullets and the ammunition out of their hands. Let's stop giving them what they're looking for. Let's start doing these certain things. Let's start doing this certain thing over here. You know, let's not antagonize police when you don't have the power to you know, fight the police. Let's not hang around and do things after school when you know that they're going to be looking to pin things on you after school. Let's make sure that when your parents ask you to be in house at a certain time, that you're in there 15 minutes early. Why? Because if you're not in there 15 minutes early and then something happens, you don't have anybody that's going to come to your defense. And these are all things that, you know, when you explain it to them and then you explain to them why, you know, the system is set up to catch you slipping, and that there's a whole warehouse of black children that are being, you know, placed in these foster homes and these boarding schools that they masquerade as placement facilities for children, then they get to see the full picture and they understand, and it makes things a lot easier. When you have to sit there and nitpick and dance around things, you're just as bad as everybody else is lying to them. And I refuse to do that in this day and age. We just don't have time.
Okay. So
too real for you, Joe?
Nah, it's right on point. Right on point. Right on point. Hey, Pat, don't be calling me out, though. You don't know me.
I mean,
that,
you know, the way you said okay, you seemed like you needed to be, you know.
And you don't know me, dog. You don't know me, dog. You don't know me, dog. Right, so let me talk about mobile therapy, because you're also a mobile therapist.
Yes,
so could you, you know, kind of break that down, what it is and, you know, why in your opinion is that profession necessary, or why has it been created to be utilized?
Well, mobile therapists is a cheap way of insurance companies getting out of paying for an actual trip to a therapist's office, if you want to be honest. But one of the benefits from being – so the difference between mobile therapy and having to go to an office to receive your therapy is that I come to your home, or I can meet you somewhere in public, or we can do public things. And as long as it falls under the guidelines of therapeutic remedies or therapeutic treatment, then you can be billed for it. The client won't pay. Typically, usually, it's some sort of public insurance agency that pays for the visit, but it's a billable service. So in a nutshell, I provide therapy, but I come to your house. I can see your whole family. I can see just you. I can see some of the things is in your environment where you don't have to describe it. I could just walk into a bedroom and see what's going on. I can walk into the living room. I can see the whole house dynamic. And then we can go from there and provide adequate, you know, services to make sure that the client gets everything they need therapeutically.
Okay. Coming straight to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, a way the insurance companies get off cheap.
Oh, yeah.
Real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, you were the second person that's been talked about the insurance companies with regards to, because I know Stacy talked about that last week, the hold the insurance company has on the community and how it can be restrictive in terms of us getting the care we need.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny about that is that in the welfare system that people are so hung up on, and, you know, the mental health of that itself. When you have people who really need access, they need help, and they're ashamed of the help being provided because, you know, we stigmatize them. Well, let me tell you, in these wealthy, well-to-do white communities that I serviced, the same services are offered to them. And what happens is because they go by your wages and things of that nature, or your earned income for your home based on your zip codes or based on the area you live in, you can have somebody who has a six-figure income, even a seven-figure income, receiving the same benefits as somebody who's making less than $15,000 a year. So, you know, when it comes to the stigma, and then you're talking about the insurance company, they make sure that those people get their services more readily than they do the poor people who have to struggle to make ends meet and to figure out how they're going to put food on the table. So they are restrictive, and they're also restrictive in the types of services that people can provide. I mean, these insurance companies determine not just in mental health, but also in your physical health, who lives and who dies. They have death panels where they determine who can get surgery and how much this surgery will cost and if it's worth such and such. And if there's not enough money, take this, get this now. They know that they have the means to do the surgery because the people are in the building. But if they don't get enough money by the insurance company, they will let people die. That's a sick, twisted system. You know, people, you know, playing God. And that happens more times than you think in all aspects. And a lot of people die mental health-wise because they don't get the help they need, and they end up either, you know, becoming suicidal, or they become self-destructive. And when they become self-destructive, it might as well be suicide because they're going to take on a lifestyle that's not going to produce anything but death. So, yeah, the insurance companies play a huge role in a lot of these things taking place. Let's not let them off too easy now, because the insurance companies also were huge profiteers off of the slave trade as well. So, you know, it all ties into white supremacy.
Right. All right. So speaking of white supremacy and mental health and the effects of it on mental health. So if let's say black people were free from the system of white supremacy, Can you tell us, in your opinion, how that will improve the overall mental health of Black Americans and how we interact with ourselves and others?
It would improve the overall health of mental health the same way if somebody was choking you and you finally freed yourself and you were able to take a full, fresh breath of air. If you were able to take a deep breath for the first time in your life, that's what it would do in terms of the mental health of Black people. I just came back from a trip to Mississippi, and we met up with we had our first national Black Liberation Front summit, and we got to go out to the farm, and we got to take food off the farm. We got to eat food off the farm that was made with Black hands. We got to spend time with just Black people who, if you seen them, you would say, wow, I would love to be a fly on the wall in that circle to see how these powerful minds, these powerful personas would get along. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences I can ever describe. You had the brothers assume roles of the brothers need to assume. You had the sisters assume roles that the sisters need to assume. And it wasn't a power struggle. It wasn't a fight. It wasn't anything that was dictated. It was we naturally assumed our roles as African-centered people. You know, we had ciphers. We had discussions. The only enemy we had to deal with out there were mosquitoes. But the beauty of building Black power is insurmountable. And we only had a fraction of it. And it produced an experience that, you know, everybody that was there captured and wants to hold on to and wants to continue to build with. When you start talking about an independent Black nation, think about how powerful it would be if our children, who are geniuses, were not being warred on every single day, if they were not being fired on every single day, if they were not living in literal war zones, if they were not living, not having to sleep on the floor because a bullet might whiz through their window, if they were not living thinking, if I walk to school today, I might get caught in a crossfire, if they were not living thinking that I don't have any allies on the street, all I see is enemies, if they didn't have to live like that, imagine how creative they could be now. Imagine how bright and brilliant. Remember where we come from. We come from civilizations that created things thousands of years ago that you still can't mimic today. We come from that. That genetic coding is still in us, but it's imprisoned. It's oppressed. And if we break free of that, when we break free of that, you'll get to see that magic they talk about with Black people. You'll get to see that on display all day long, every day long. But we have to be able to protect it.
Okay. Yeah, no, I get it. I just wanted you to break that down and kind of explain that for the audience and some of the listeners, not all of us, but some of the listeners, you know, what freeing ourselves from white supremacy would do. But I like how you started off. It's like same as, hey, if you're choking me and you let go, I can breathe. So that was, you know, that was great. That's why I had to chuckle with it. It was great, right, in your face and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, because there's so much information out here to really back up what you're saying and what everybody's saying about how slavery has created the PTSS, the post-traumatic stress syndrome, and, you know, Stockholm syndrome and all these other names that we give it, Jackie Robinson syndrome, all these things here that we talk about that Black people go through. So with that being said, because we've talked about the effects of white supremacy and mental health issues and everything that you bring to the mental health field. So, I've asked all of our guests this question because I just think it's a relevant and important question. As far as resources, what mental health resources are available for Black people to utilize, and how can they best access those resources?
there's a school in Baltimore where it was considered in-school suspension, right? Behavioral room or whatever they call it, behavioral support room. They would send children there all the time, and their children would go to that room, and those children wouldn't learn anything. Those children had to sit in there, do schoolwork, and by the time they were done, the children came back out and continued to raise havoc. They since changed the process to when the children are sent to their room, they have to practice meditation and yoga.
Right. I saw that.
They have reported a dramatic decrease in the level of violence that those or interactions of physical aggression or verbal aggression even, that those children, once those children go through that process. See, the answers to what we need, we were born with. The issue is the fact that they went back and they created a chemical dependency prior to a birth of a child, with the parent being chemically dependent on, you know, substances like heroin, crack cocaine, even marijuana, or alcohol. And so the children would come out chemically dependent, and so they would then put the children on medications that replicated or mimicked heroin, crack cocaine, and et cetera, et cetera. So what they did was create a factory where they knew that they could consistently have black children, and these black children would consistently be, would need their fix. So that's what you have right now in the current mental health issue. What I'm saying is we need to go back to natural remedies. We have a lot of places now where black people are going back to the herbs. We have the schools that Dr. Sebi has set up, and many herbologists have followed his lead. We need to go to those things. Those are resources. We need to seek black professionals who understand the system of white supremacy to become therapists for our children.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of black professionals, but we have a lot of Negropeans as well, and they themselves don't understand the need to understand our culture, understand who we are, where we come from, and the damages that white supremacy has inflicted upon us. And we need to be able to structure that, and we need to create that database so that we can start going out there and studying the harms and effects of white supremacy, so we can have an accurate readout. Nobody to this date has created, that I know of, the database that's necessary to understand the harmful effects of white supremacy. To this day, people are telling their children to be in the house before the lights go on.
Yeah.
But they know nothing. Nothing about Sundown Town epidemic. Right? You know, those things have to be transferred. Those things have to be taught. Vagrancy laws. Those were plantation rules. You know, and now they're back again. You know, this overwhelming fear, you know, we have to overcome the fear. Teach our children not to be afraid of who they are or their enemy. When I say teach your children, I talk about the children a lot, because it's come to a point where if you're over the age of 25, you're already set in your ways. It's going to take something dramatic to change that.
Yeah.
But these babies, they haven't been fully indoctrinated. So we can terraform their minds to the things and the places that need to be, So, you know, the resources are growing because we have more people getting our children into African-centered theology and education. Those are some of the things. So they can come to PAX, because if they go to PAX Inc., they can have a full reservoir of information about who they are and where they come from. They can go to, you know, On the Shoulders of Giants and learn the significance of brothers and our ancestors, you know, brothers and sisters, black men and black women, who fought against the incursion of white supremacy. They can watch the Independence Day Project. So, you know, shameless plug.
Hey, plug it.
To learn about who they are, where they come from, most importantly, what it takes to build an independent black community. And they can also see the, because through that they see the vision. And then when they see, you know, we'll talk about that later, but we're going to be addressing not just the vision, but how to get there.
There it is.
I thought it was interesting. Well, not interesting, but when you mentioned about the importance and the significance of being in black spaces, that's something that, you know, I remember it first dawned on me. I mean, I grew up in Tallahassee, same as Joe, and at the time I didn't realize Tallahassee was as segregated as it was. You know, growing up in an environment, that environment becomes normal to you if that's all you've seen. So we knew, you know, that there was white people in town somewhere, but we weren't really worried about them because they weren't where we were. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, you knew how to get to their side of town, and we assumed they knew how to get to ours as well. I'm pretty sure they did. But everybody just kind of stayed on their side. You just kind of stayed where you were. So I grew up around black people, surrounded by black people. But when I talked to my girl Yanni, and Yanni is a Somalian, Somalian refugee who's relocated to America. And, you know, I talked to her. We talked pretty frequently, but she was the first person that really explained to me the difference. You know, she talked about growing up in Somalia. And for those of you that don't know, that's in Africa. But when she talked about growing up in Somalia, she talked about the pride and the comfortability, not even the pride, just the comfortability that she had of being in her skin. Everybody looked like her. There were different shades, but everybody was black. The standard of beauty was a black standard. We just talked about how, you know, that type of environment just created a level of confidence that she doesn't see in American people, even when they do grow up in all black environments, because they're still, even if you grow up in a bubble, that bubble is still penetrated by the system on a consistent and regular basis. So when you talked about being in that environment in Mississippi, it made me think about that, because I think that's something that a lot of black people are like, well, I grew up with black people. You know, you hear the same thing when we're talking about pro-black studies. And, well, why would I need to major in African-American history? I'm black. And you hear that same thing when you talk about what you just said, where people are like, I grew up around all black people, so, you know, I don't feel no type of special type of way about it or whatever the case might be. You know, it's just, it is what it is. I thought it was interesting that you brought that angle up and being in that environment and it feeling different, even despite you and yourself living in a black community. So I wanted to harp on that a little bit. I wanted to bring people's attention back to it, because I think, you know, when you said that was kind of a powerful thing for me, because like I said, I remember having those conversations with Yanni. I know last time she came back from Somalia, you know, she said she cried when she got home and got off the plane, just because when she got back to Somalia and got off the plane, she was talking about how she cried because the entire energy was different. And it was just something that she had forgotten about being in America. She had just wasn't used to it anymore. So, you know, I was just like, when you said all that, it just brought all those things back about how powerful it is to experience that sort of environment. That's all.
Well, you know, that's the key, see. We have this imaginary bubble we live in here in America, but it's not really a bubble of all, and it's not a bubble of our creation. This thing that we live in right now is a facsimile a washed out version of white supremacy that we implement within our own community, and we do so in our communities with the terrible and horrifying images of each other that they've implanted into us. Whereas when you go back to Africa, even though you have a lot of places in Africa that are war and torn, they still have a semblance of who they are. They still have a semblance of pride and community that comes with nationhood. And that's why it's so important for us to have a nation within a nation here, you know, as we're part of the diaspora. And as we become more ingratiated in terms of building a black first mentality, a black first theology, and a black first understanding of how we should function, that will become clearer to us. And for all those Negroes that are fighting us on that, it's cool. Don't waste any energy on them, because they themselves have bought into this stigmatized, the stigmatized version of who they see themselves as. They have already accepted the glass ceilings that have been allotted to them. Whereas we're not talking about that at all. We're talking about breaking free and having our own independent communities and nations in which we build. And once we build those things, we don't have to worry about nobody else's opinions of us. We don't have to worry about what your propaganda says, because we're going to be protecting and insulating ourselves. We're going to promote our own propaganda. We're going to produce our own protections. We're going to produce our own cultural norms. We're going to produce our own cultural what's accepted in terms of what it is to be culture. And we're going to protect it, and our culture is going to protect us. So that's a very astute observation. And I feel, because when I got back to Philadelphia, let me tell you, it was a whole change. There was a change in my thought process. There was a change in just the nature of the people around me. You could feel the energy. You could feel the energy turn, getting off that flight. It was horrible. And, you know, it's so when it comes to building, I know what power lies within when we go and decide to build our own nation, because I felt that I got a taste of it. And when people get a taste of it, they're going to crave that. They're going to say, I don't want pork no more. I don't want to eat that crap no more. I want this good food over here. I want this stuff that comes off the earth. I want to be energized when I eat. You know, I don't want to eat and then have the itis. I want to eat, you know, so all those things come with that. And when people start to experience it more and let themselves go and let go of this American nightmare that we, you know, have legitimized to be a dream, then we'll be more functional and better prepared to do the things we need to do.
That is true. That's definite. So we're at the point in the show where we're down to our final question. You know,
it's Joe.
Huh?
I'm sorry. I was muted when I responded to what he just said.
All good.
Go ahead and say it, my brother. Go ahead and say it.
I appreciate that. See, that's why I fucks with you.
Too late.
Go ahead. It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and Pepper. Heavy D in the limousine. All right. Go ahead.
So you ready for your question?
Yes, sir.
All right. So here we go, Pat. Let's get it.
So if you were in charge of providing mental health care to the nation, and you could do whatever you wanted, what would you change, and how would you use the resources to improve the health of black people in America?
Okay. First of all, I would put somebody more qualified. You know, if that was the option, I would pick somebody that's highly that's more qualified than I. You know, I would go to the Dr. Joy DeGruy. You know, I would go to a Dr. Layla Africa. And I would seek their guidance, because they're more qualified in dealing with the health of black people than I am right now, specifically the mental health aspect of it. But if I were picked to quarry in that particular area, First thing I do is get rid of genetically modified foods. I get rid of our heavily based meat diets. And I wouldn't necessarily get rid of all meat, but I would strongly, enforce and infuse affordable, healthy, green-based diets, And the reason behind that is because I'm just sick of seeing our people dying. They say for mental health, the second brain is in your gut. And a lot of us have a lot of rot in our guts right now. So, I would do what I can to establish a way for our people to eradicate that that rot that's in our gut, so that we can cleanse our second brain, because that's where you get a lot of your emotional inhibitors and a lot of the chemicals that we use to balance us emotionally. It comes from there. I would push more physical activities. You've seen an uptick in violence because you have children who don't have, they're bound with energy. They just don't have any way to exercise or any way to work it out. So I would change school diets. Ketchup would no longer be considered a vegetable. Is it still a vegetable? I would make sure that free breakfast, a hot free breakfast, or a breakfast that provided the necessities of fruits, vegetables, was given, the fewer complex carbohydrates, which, these are sugary products that are produced in the mornings, and then you have a child sit down for, 4 hours straight after ingesting all that sugar. Is just impossible. Less reliance on these pharmaceutical psychotropic drugs, which are designed for you to become lifelong customers and consumers. I would mandate that insurance companies would pay for herbal remedies, and that way we would have a healthier treatment to anything that's ailing us. And I would make sure that everybody was educated on how their diet has a strong effect and tie into their mental health. So those are just some of the things. But like I said, the first thing I would do is go to people who are more qualified and seek their guidance in terms of doing that.
I like that. I like that, taking a holistic approach to improving mental health instead of just going straight toward, focusing on the mind and the brain, focusing on the whole person and the environment, because all of that plays a part in the person's mental state. So I like that. And it's different. It's very, very, very different answers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So where can people find you? How can people contact you? If somebody want to get the Independence Day Project, how do they get in contact with you to get their copy? Or, they just want to contact you. How do they do that?
Well, they can go to my website, blackindependence.org. They can go to the website, blackindependence.org. And they can hit me up through the email correspondence there. They can drop a message. I am notified when the messages are, when someone leaves a message. You can also contact me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter and all the other social media outlets. Just if they Google Carl Tone Jones, they'll be able to find me. All those different media platforms. And one of the things that I want to drop before we leave is, we're talking about improving the mental health of a community. The understanding of nationalism is a very powerful tool. Let's just be clear as to why that you have all of these book companies now that are ingrained in curriculum creation. All these book companies are now withdrawing all the evil deeds of white supremacy in terms of the gestation of this country. They're removing the Trail of Tears. They don't want their children to learn about how devious they were. They're planting smallpox in the blankets as they, you know, marshaled Native people and Black people off their land, you know, on that trail. They don't want people to know that. They're removing the word slavery from history books, so involuntary immigrants, because they don't want the stain of slavery to be on the mindsets and the consciousness of their children, because they want to promote nationhood. They want to promote pride in this thing they call America, and they want the children to carry on that prestige. It builds and empowers them. So that's why we must empower Black children with Black nationalism. We must empower them with their African-centered self. So when we talk about African-centered education, we don't have to keep teaching about Timbuktu, but that child to see his or her name in the textbook, that child should see his or her likeness in that math, that word problem. That child should see his or herself as centered, as the education is centered around who they are. So it empowers them to know that this, that they're the emphasis, they're the focus, and that they themselves are important. And this is why they've been ingrained and ingratiated into the educational process. So we must do those things if we're going to empower our children. And be on the lookout for the Independence Day Project, the second edition, the, you know, as we like to call it, practical application. Because just like we talked about earlier, where the first movie was about the vision, the second one is going to be about the practical application of all the things we talked about in part one. So.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Appreciate you for coming, jumping on the train with us once again as we, you know, do our best to play a part in bringing more awareness to mental health in the Black community. So we encourage everybody to go to the website, www.freedomtrainradio.com, so you can listen to all of the interviews that we had about mental health awareness and all those things. So, Professor, man, thank you for being on the show with us. We're going to hold you up no longer. We know you got other stuff to do, so thank you for being on here with us. And we're definitely going to talk to you soon, my brother.
Always a pleasure to be on board of Freedom Train. I appreciate you, brother.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
All right, cool soon. Peace.
Yeah, and we'll cool soon. Yeah, wake up, clean up, stand up, unmute, all that stuff. Ah, on point. There it is, Pat, on point.
Already.
Already. You got any parting shots?
Power to the people.
Power to the people. Hey, man, it's Mental Health Awareness Month. Make sure you're taking care of yourself. You're taking care of yourself. All right? That's what we're doing, is to make sure that we give you more resources. And, yeah, we do it in August because we feel like doing it in August. That's how we do it around here. So I'm Joseph Ward. He's Patrick Irvin. This is the Freedom Train podcast series, Two Fingers in the Air. And we out this week.